Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives. The author is Ellen Brown, and it is a book that everyone should read. In the solution area, we have tapped into a number of sources and resources, in particular the Thrive Movement website, thrivemovement.com. We specifically investigated into the top 10 actions, what you can do in terms of solutions. Those, as a brief review, are 1. Get informed, speak up, and connect with others. 2. Bank locally. 3. Buy and invest responsibly. 4. Join the movement to audit and end the Federal Reserve. 5. Keep the internet fair and open. 6. Support independent media. 7. Support organic non-GMO farming. 8. Require election and campaign finance reform. 9. Advocate for renewable and free energy. And 10. Take part in critical mass action. To start off this show today, and before I come back to economic solutions, I want to review and finish off an item which we ended that show with. This is a critical concept to be thinking about as everyone is rushing around starting to think about college in the fall and getting financing for it. What we discover is that people who are going to school, many of them are actually drowning in debt. For the first time ever in the U.S., student loan debt has topped $1 trillion. And in comparison to credit card debt, it actually has exceeded credit card debt, which when you think about it, it's mostly younger people who are getting this, whereas credit card debt crosses the age spectrums. Insofar as the debt itself, the top 1% of student loan borrowers owe more than $150,000 each. Americans now owe more than they do on their credit cards, which is about $830 billion. And this actually is more than the gross domestic product of Australia, which is almost $25 billion. The student loan debt in America is over $1 trillion. In fact, total student loan debt in the United States is now increasing at a rate of $2,854 per second. and students are taking higher loans for higher tuition costs. 65% of students graduate with debt, and the price change since 1985 of student loan debt has escalated from 100% to almost 600%, or six times what it cost in 1985. In comparison, medical care has gone 3.5 times higher since 1985. Gasoline has been up and down, but as of today, it is three times higher, and all consumer items since 1985 are over twice as expensive as they were. Looking at tuition itself in the last 10 years, the average tuition in 2002 was about $11,380. In 2012, the average tuition is $20,986. So people are coming out of college, obviously, with a lot of debt. Great way to start your career. On the average, it takes at least 15 years to pay off a student loan. 2 years after graduation, 45% of graduates make only $15,000 a year. I know that is very hard to believe, but that's the case, assuming they've even gotten a job. It's also true that if they went to work at McDonald's, they would make $800 more yearly as a food worker. Not that I'm suggesting this, it just goes to show you how convoluted the whole system is. And in addition, it is a fact that one in three graduates take a job that does not even require a college degree. So they're coming out of college with a fair amount, if not huge amount, of debt. And did they really even need that degree? It turns out that 24.5% of all retail salespersons have a college degree. Parking lot attendants, waiters and waitresses, cashiers, all these kinds of people. In short, their college degree has not given them any advantage in the financial world. That is, at least an advantage to capitalize on their degree. And then you have to add in the other horrific point that even while the student debt grows, wages remain stagnant. In 2006, the average debt of new graduates was $19,646. By 2011, it was $25,250, which is a 28% increase. Then you compare that to the fact in 2006, the median weekly earnings of graduates over 25 years old was $1,040. And in 2011, that median weekly earnings is $1,144, or just a 10% increase. When we look at it in total, one out of every four students not only have student debt, but have past due balances. In total, there is $85 billion of student loan defaults. There are a number of different kinds of student loans, not-for-profit, public, and for-profit. So, for example, you'll get different default rates. 2007, 2008, 2009, as 3 years I'm going to use, not-for-profit went from 3.7% in 07, 4% in 08, and 4.6% in 09. Going into public kinds of loans, 2007, 5.9% default, 2008, 6%, and 2009, 7.2%. And finally, for-profit, 2007, it was 11%, 2008, it was 11.6%, and 2009, it was all the way up to 15% defaults. And of course, this affects the way graduates live. Student loans are making it harder to buy houses. First-time home buyers aged 29 to 34 years. In 2001, that was 17%. In 2011, that's only 9%. So that's a drastic reduction. Moreover, 85% of college students move back home after graduation. And it turns out that 14.2% of 25 to 34 year olds still live with their parents. 14% of graduates delay marriage because of student debt, and 21% delay having kids. And finally, student loans cannot be shed in bankruptcy, even though the bankruptcy lawyers are working tirelessly to try to change this. So be careful on student loans. And I'll come back in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So I just had gone over student loan debt, and I'd like to give credit to onlineschools.org, which outlined that particular series of facts. The next thing I'd like to discuss is, again, more economic solution strategies and, in a sense, a review of things I've done in other shows. Even the most informed experts disagree on how to solve economic crises. What is obvious, however, is that there is a considerable lack of debate on serious alternatives to our current economy. We want to get beyond the usual discussion and explore revolutionary possibilities that actually get to the root of the problem. And as an aside, again, much of this is coming directly from ThriveMovement.com. The research of Thrive and information they have discovered directly implicates the global central banking system, of which the Federal Reserve is a key part in the United States. This is nothing new. This is exactly what Ellen Brown had discussed in her book, The Web of Debt, as do many other people like Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. In his remarks to Congress, for example, Kucinich said that on a day Congress will decide whether to audit the Fed, the Washington Post reports that the New York Fed did not communicate in key meetings with top regulators that British bank Barclays had admitted to Fed staffers that it was rigging LIBOR, the index which sets interest rates worldwide. The Fed wants to be spared a full audit. They want monetary deliberations private. They then use that privacy shield to keep the irregularities from regulators and from congressional view, exposing investors and consumers to massive losses. Of course, the Fed wants to continue a system where there is no transparency, no accountability, where they can cover up manipulations of markets and interest rates. But should we endorse this system? When things fall apart, who do the banks come to clean up the mess? Congress. The Fed creates trillions of dollars out of nothing and gives it to the banks. Congress is in the dark. The Fed sets the stage for the subprime meltdown. Congress is in the dark. The Fed takes a dive on LIBOR. Congress is in the dark. The Fed doesn't tell regulators what is going on. Congress is in the dark. It is time for us to bring the Fed into the sunshine of accountability. So again, those were quotes from Dennis Kucinich. The research and information implicates the global central banking system as the root of the problem, and the Federal Reserve is a key part in the United States, creating devastation and suffering that so many people are experiencing around the world. Powerful elite bankers have literally hijacked governments, wielding more influence than any other sector. We have seen and experienced it in the most recent economic collapse. Wall Street bankers who created the problem were then bailed out with taxpayer money, ultimately gaining even more power, not to mention more wealth, clearly making banks who were already too big to fail even bigger. Rather, it sets everyone up for being more vulnerable in the future and gives banks even more control over our government and over us. Now, obviously, the challenge here is that you can't really have quick fix approaches. Ultimately, we need to give less power to bankers and more opportunity for prosperity to everyone. What Thrive has suggested, as many people now, many organizations, are three stages. Reform the current system. The second stage would be limit government control. And the third would be voluntary cooperation. When we reform the current systems, we bring transparency and accountability to the economic system. This includes, first of all, dismantling the Federal Reserve, restoring money-making capacities to Congress, monetizing the debt, and withdrawing support from harmful international banking agencies such as the World Bank, the IMF, and the Bank for International Settlements, which effectively run the entire global economy and then, through their decisions, the entire world. In reformation, that's stage one, reforming central banking and getting the economy working for the people, not the bankers, is the goal. In order to achieve this, the proposal is to shut down the Federal Reserve and temporarily giving its powers to Congress. This would have to coincide with campaign finance reform to get special interests out of Washington and make sure politicians are representing the people. Reform in stage one also includes monetization of the debt and abolishing harmful international banking agencies. So first, how do you dismantle the Federal Reserve? Well, dismantling the Federal Reserve will likely require mass mobilization against its practices and an education campaign exposing its failures. That's what I've been trying to do for the last year and a half. You can sign up to participate in critical mass actions to audit and end the Federal Reserve. You can do that on the Thrive Movement website. And also support those politicians like Dennis Kucinich, if not being able to vote for him, but by any in your voting area with the same idea to have a direct impact on the Federal Reserve. As pressure mounts, we need a strategy in place to ensure a smooth transition so that it doesn't result in economic chaos. Congress must temporarily be in charge of the entire economy that gets shifted from the Federal Reserve. People generally do not support more government power in the long run. It seems necessary to restore economic functions, though, to the government as we dismantle the central banking system and explore new alternatives, some of which I've discussed in past shows. It will be absolutely critical to make all economic decision-making accessible and transparent to the public. And that's really a key concept, transparency. We want to know what is going on. Whether we're dealing with the brilliancy of Noam Chomsky or others like him, the idea is to get the smoke and mirrors stopped and the facts on the table for everyone from the root level up to discover what is the truth and what is going on and make their decisions with that information. More televised hearings and debates would help facilitate more public interaction and accountability. And the real blessing of the internet is to go and research there, and you will see a lot is going on already. And I'll come back to this in a moment. For those of you just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And again, by way of review, new government functions would likely include printing and lending money at low or fixed interest rates at the federal, state, and or municipal levels. And as we discussed, there are successful models from the past and ones that are working even today. For example, North Dakota, as we discussed last week and the week before, currently has a state bank that has managed to maintain a surplus amidst the economic crisis. In 2008, while the rest of the country was on the verge of bankruptcy, North Dakota had a surplus of $1.2 billion. So dismantling the Federal Reserve is a critical initial stage for reform. Another important step in reform is to withdraw support from the IMF, the World Bank, and the Bank for International Settlements. This international banking trio is, frankly, and I've done a lot of reading on this in various articles and even books like Confessions of an Economic Hitman, for example, that the trio is actively behind closed doors, again, no transparency, intentionally affecting global destruction and gaining control just about everywhere. They bankrupt countries, charge astronomical interest rates, require unfair loan conditions, and create development strategies that benefit multinational corporations rather than the residents of the country. There are many stories of how this has happened throughout the world. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, serves as a sort of lender of last resort to developing or struggling countries. Although its stated goal is to alleviate poverty, all loans are issued with very strict conditions and regulations that usually end up weakening economies, burying governments, and putting their people in debt, and opening up the market to devastating transnational corporations. Again, read the books or articles by John Perkins, The Economic Hitman, and you get a very clear picture of what happens. Then there's also the World Bank. Although the World Bank represents 184 countries, it is run by a small group of the most powerful nations who in turn promote their own interests. The president of the World Bank, for example, is nominated by the president of the United States and has always been a citizen of the U.S. Like the IMF, the World Bank also issues structural adjustment loans, which place restrictions on how the money can be spent. For example, a World Bank loan may require privatization of the water supply, which benefits transnational corporations and undermines the rights of the people. In this way, the World Bank can manipulate and control growth in the developing world to benefit itself, and it's always at the expense of the indigenous people. And then there's the Bank for International Settlements. The Rothschilds-created Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, served as a bank for central banks. It has 55 member central banks, but is mainly run by bankers from the United States, England, Germany, Switzerland, Italy, and Japan. Unlike the IMF and World Bank, it operates with much less transparency and is not accountable to national governments. Nevertheless, it has significant control over the global financial system by setting capital requirements and reserve controls. Evidence shows it played a key role in Japan's recession in the late 1980s and more recently contributed to the financial meltdown in the U.S. by enforcing the Basel II Accords, which required banks to adjust the value of their marketable securities in November of 2007. Private individuals within the BIS are making key economic decisions without any public scrutiny. This certainly needs to come to an end. You can actually see more about this in Ellen Brown's article, The Tower of Basel. As I said before, another way to reform the system is by vocally refusing international taxes. The UN and other international organizations are pushing policies that could help set up a global taxing system. Caps and trades is just one example. This would consolidate power even more, so don't go for it. Again, by way of review, something we have discussed quite a lot is monetizing the debt. With the government issuing fiat currency itself, rather than the Federal Reserve, we could eliminate the national debt. The national debt consists of securities, bills, bonds, and notes. The U.S. government could simply issue new fiat currency to buy back all the securities and take them out of circulation. Because securities act as cash, this would not increase the overall money supply and cause inflation. Instead, it would just eliminate the debt, and taxpayers would no longer have to pay interest on it. If it's so simple, you might ask, why don't we just do it now? Well, because the Federal Reserve currently has the power to issue currency. When the Federal Reserve buys securities, it doesn't make them void. Instead, the securities become reserves for issuing many times their value in new loans. This compounds the problem of ever-rising inflation. If we dismantle the Federal Reserve, however, and give its power to Congress, then we could easily eliminate the debt. The second stage was to limit government. In stage two, which significantly overlaps stage one, we want to limit government functions to the protection of individual rights and to empower people to run their own local economies, create competitive currencies, and allow a truly free market without government intervention. This would involve repealing legal tender laws to allow other currencies to emerge and compete, eliminating government subsidies, rolling back entitlement programs, and limiting taxes. It would also involve a transition away from state-run banks to privately run diverse banking systems. Repealing legal tender laws, which, although stage one involves setting up some kind of service-based government banks, they would not be the only ones. In stage two, other currency and banking systems should be encouraged and allowed to compete for customers. Banks could take multiple forms, and they all need to compete in the open market. Some issue local currencies, others are 100% backed by silver or gold, others owned and run by community members, etc. Fractional reserve lending would be illegal to safeguard borrowers from fraudulent banking practices. Then also eliminate government subsidies and bailouts. Subsidized businesses have an unfair advantage that allows them to remain competitive. In stage two, any business that is unable to compete in the free market should be allowed to fall without government bailouts or subsidies. Commercial farms, for example, which have brought down the price of food and pushed small organic farms out of business, would no longer be subsidized. Commodity prices would begin to reflect the real value, and the best and most trustworthy businesses would rise to the top. Another point is used increased personal wealth to take over government's mismanaged entitlement programs. As money is freed up for everyone by decreasing taxes, there would be more opportunity to care for one another rather than rely on government services funded by taxpayers. Services such as welfare, Social Security, and Medicare would actually no longer be needed because all people would have more resources with which to support themselves and help support each other. Evidence shows that people who are free to prosper are more inclined and better able to take care of each other than the state. This naturally can bring up a lot of fear from concerned citizens who want to ensure that everyone is cared for at a basic level. That's okay. However, government programs have been very inefficient, often ineffective, and do not allow for complete empowerment and recovery the way prosperous people can and do. And then also limit taxes to protection of individual rights and commons. Most of our taxes in the U.S. currently go to the military and interest on the debt. In stage two, which we've been discussing, taxes would dramatically decrease. They would still be needed to protect from pollution of the commons, air, the water, and the land that we all share, and basic human protection until stage three is sufficient to protect people, their prosperity, and shared common spaces. And next week we will continue with stage three, set up systems for voluntary cooperation. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.